Hello, and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik. Greg is off this week. My guest is Tom Leslie. He is the author of Chicago Skyscrapers, 1934 to 1986, as well as the previous edition, which covered the period, I believe, 1871 to 1933.
Correct.
Yes. Welcome, Tom. He is a very well-known scholar of skyscrapers and built history, and we've collaborated on many things before, and it's great to have you back again.
Good to be here.
Indeed. So this second book has an interesting subtitle. It's in a series. I presume there will be three total, taking us up to the present. The second book subtitle is How Technology, Politics, Finance, and Race Reshaped the City. And so, you know, when I think back about, you know, some of your prior scholarship, it felt like it was more focused on construction technology and the development of, you know, structural engineering and some of the specific developments that took us to the present day skyscraper. Here, I felt like there was more of a story about the politics of the city, the sort of backroom dealings that happen, and the racial politics that were very prevalent during the Daley era, especially. What sort of motivated you to take that tack with this information?
Well, I think the kind of facts of the case, the first book, you're right, was very kind of object oriented. And I think that has to do with the nature of building at the time. Chicago in particular had a very laissez-faire government in the 19th century, and they were willing more or less to let developers and builders sort of do their own thing. And, you know, 15 years ago or so, that was where my kind of interest in scholarship was, in the, you know, specifically in the kind of nuts and bolts of skyscrapers. That period, it was a really good period to look at. It's a great example of what happens when the kind of technology is really driving things. This period, as I got into it, it was very clear that obviously there's a great story about the technology that goes into something like Sears Tower or the Hancock. But the technology in a lot of ways has to be seen in this era in context. And that's partly just, you know, my own kind of evolution in thinking about this stuff, but also a very different set of subjects to look at. You can certainly take the buildings of the post-war era and think of them as objects, right? Or you know, kind of gadgets, right? Machines for making the land pay in the sort of classic formulation. But it's difficult, I think, to look at anything in post-war Chicago without understanding the politics, without understanding the economics, without understanding the racial dynamics in the city that were going on. And sure enough, you know, even if you zoom in to the most minute details of these buildings, if you think about, you know, who is actually doing the welding, or who is actually, you know, driving the trucks to the job site or whatever, you run into very quickly the larger context of the city. So the subtitle is something we thought about quite a bit, and I think it's actually really appropriate that, you know, there is that kind of clarifying statement on the cover of this one that sort of says, oh, this is about more than just the nuts and bolts, right? This is definitely about how that technology gets leveraged to various ends, not only by developers, but also by politicians in Chicago, but also nationally. It's a much broader story. And in some ways, I think, you know, maybe a more interesting one that way.
Definitely. There's a lot of compelling narratives in here, and it really does span the gamut from, you know, gruesome construction accidents to, you know, backroom wrangling and this whole sort of atmosphere, particularly in the Daley era. He was mayor for those who aren't familiar with Chicago, from 1955 to 1976, when he died in office. He was perhaps the singular biggest shaper of 20th century Chicago. It's almost impossible to have a conversation about Chicago in that period without, and if you're talking about architecture, there's two giant figures, right? There's Mies van der Rohe and there's Richard J. Daley. So how did you approach the the sort of the political machine aspects of this? Where did you go for your research? What kind of archives did you go through?
Well, one of the earliest grants that I had was a small grant from the University of Illinois at Chicago to look at the Daley collection in their library. And as you can imagine, the Daley collection is frustrating in a lot of ways because that, no one wrote anything down. Everything was a kind of handshake deal. And so the Daley archives are, an awful lot of sort of birthday wishes going back and forth, but certainly no, smoking gun. Fortunately, the Daley administration has been written about by all sorts of historians. There is a fantastic, very, very thorough biography of Daley published maybe 10 years ago that was a great kind of introduction to the depth of the machine. But also just looking at the sort of larger history of the city, the larger history of Daley in particular, there's plenty out there to sort of get into. What was particularly interesting to me, though, was looking at contemporary press accounts, and especially in Daley's early years, it was very clear that one of his missions was to remake the city. And the central area plan, which was the outcome of these kind of early machinations on his part, was really a blueprint where, I think about it like Chicago is this kind of massive game board, right? And skyscrapers were sort of Daley's chess pieces to try to reorganize, to refocus the city, to keep the loop an active central business district, but also to kind of nourish it with workers at all levels from the areas immediately surrounding the loop. That was easy to get into because you can find the actual document, the Central Area Plan, and it was also written about quite a bit in the local press, both in the kind of white newspapers, the Tribune and the Sun-Times, but also the Chicago Defender, the South Side newspaper that took a very, very different approach to a lot of what was going on. So it was kind of a having to sort of educate yourself in the history of the city at a maybe deeper level. I think any Chicagoan knows the name Richard J. Daley and has some understanding that here was a mayor who really accumulated power and put it to work for a lot of different ends. But getting into the I guess the mechanics of how that power was used to build and to encourage building and how that literally did reshape the city. That was a kind of new tack for me and something that I really enjoyed getting into. I mean, it's such a great story, one of the great kind of American political stories.
I mean, one of the things I was really struck by, I mean, we know that Richard J. Daley was caught on camera saying all kinds of horrible things, especially during the Democratic convention. And he was quoted saying all kinds of things in the papers. But I was also surprised by the it wasn't like he was acting alone here. I mean, in his divisive approach to using architecture, construction, design to shape the city and to divide it. I was really shocked by the statements of people like, was it Arthur Rubloff, who was the developer who basically just flat out said, State Street, that's a shopping district for black people. We're not going to bother with it. We're going to build on Michigan Avenue. That was like, whoa, I can't believe people just out and out said that. And it was like, not that long ago. That was like in the late 60s.
Yeah, it's recent history, and the legacy of that is still with us. I think it's really easy to think of Daley as this sort of slightly evil power mad genius, and I don't think that's quite true. I think that Daley and even to some extent Rubloff, that's simply reportage, right? That's both their attitudes, but it also, Rubloff was a businessman. Daley was a politician. They were very in tune with what all Chicagoans, but particularly white Chicagoans, wanted, what they were fearful of. And I think it's sometimes too easy to look at these figures as villains and be able to kind of push aside the fact that no, the problem wasn't these, you know, these handfuls of politicians or businessmen. The problem was this really entrenched segregationist tendency in Chicago itself that got channeled in ways that, you're right, you know, we read today and we find absolutely shocking. But I think that it's too easy to pin that on the actual figures and to sort of forget the fact that that was widely held sentiment, you know, throughout the city. And Daley, I think, you know, Daley is the paradigm case of the complicated politician, particularly in 1968 and the last few years of his regime. You know, he comes across as really a kind of, you know, a conservative, even kind of retrograde, sort of angry, you know, almost right wing politician. And that's a kind of unfortunate end. I think there's a lot in his administration that, you know, literally did like rebuild the city, and that at least in the early days really believed in and I think to some extent put into practice the idea that, you know, a rising tide in Chicago would lift everyone. It was probably overly optimistic, and I think you can see him and his kind of partners getting a little bit disillusioned, getting jaded as things didn't quite work out. In the early days, I think there was a generally kind of progressive idea behind a lot of what they tried to put into action, what they tried to implement. Some of it very naive, but also I think a lot of it pretty well intentioned.
You know, I recently had the opportunity to interview Carol Willis of the Skyscraper Museum, whom I know you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, she has a very New York-centric view of everything, as you know. But it's also a very economically centered viewpoint. And I wonder if you feel, if you're in agreement with her or other scholars of the New York-Chicago dichotomy, where it's not as if they're nobody was out to make any money and no one was out to you know, make a profit on these buildings. Do you think that the civic hand was stronger in Chicago during this period than in New York? Or how do those dynamics differ?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think skyscrapers in Chicago in the post-war era were multidimensional in a way that they weren't necessarily in a lot of other cities. Obviously, there is a financial motive, and there were plenty of speculative projects in the city, but a lot of them were kind of individual corporations trying to build their flagship headquarters. And, you know, being part of the kind of Daley regime, you know, both State Street, but also, you know, LaSalle Street, were interested in, you know, matching their corporate identity with the identity of the city. So I do think you get a slightly different attitude there, where, you know, the kind of big Chicago banks or the couple of Chicago insurance firms that are here really do want to contribute to both, you know, making the Loop a sustainable business center, but also, you know, buying into this idea of a new image for the city. I think the other thing, though, too, is that, you know, Chicago embarked on this governmental building plan, the Daley Center, you know, basically an annex to City Hall, but also the Federal Center and 20 years too late, but the State of Illinois Center. You know, these were all investments by government in the Loop, and not just in kind of making sure that their workers stayed in the Central Business District, which was one of the Central Area Plan's real goals, but also contributing these civic monuments to the city, and with them the kind of open plazas. There was a new federal building built in Manhattan in the 60s. There were new municipal buildings, but I don't think any of them had the civic ambition that Chicago's did.
Yeah, really interesting. While we're talking about the big corporations that, of course, wanted to keep their workers downtown, and were definitely in cahoots with the mayoralty to make sure that happened, obviously the biggest one was Sears. So the land clearance story about the Sears site was really interesting. I actually heard a different version of that told at the 50th anniversary commemoration of the completion of the tower, which was held a couple weeks ago. Can you relay that a little bit and how that plays into this whole narrative?
Yeah, sure. Sears was the Daley administration's crowning achievement, right? They not only kept Sears in the city, but they convinced Sears to move from their Lawndale headquarters to the Loop, and to build 4 million square feet, which is, you know, an astonishing scale of construction. And to build that tall, Sears needed a full city block. And one of the kind of hallmarks of Chicago as a as an urban fabric is that we have this system of mid-block alleys, which is great, right? Keeps the trash off the streets. But if you're trying to put together a real estate deal for an entire block, that makes it difficult. You've got to negotiate with the city to clear the alleys and to basically take them over. There were realtors who had tried to put, you know, various pieces of this block together, had tried to sell it to Greyhound, had tried to sell it to other corporations, and had been sort of frustrated by the alleyway problem. Eventually, the team that did, it turned out, paid a very, very low price for the alleys, and this was a result of one of these kind of backroom deals that ended up, not that particular deal, but the group ended up in trouble later for kind of similar dealing with City Hall, that there were politicians who maybe owned a bit of land that was involved, or banks that were financing it that were kind of in on the deal. So, you know, Sears we think of as this kind of technological object, this kind of perfect, you know, super tall skyscraper record holder. But, you know, the very ground that it sits on was so immersed in Chicago politics and in this kind of not quite corrupt, but also not quite above board way that things certainly got done all the time in the in that era. To me, that's a kind of perfect story, right? That's kind of illustrates the climate, the kind of energy, the ambition, but also the sort of, you know, just skullduggery that it took to get things done in the city in that era.
So I know we've talked a lot about the Daley administration and the 1955 to 76 period. The scope of the book is wider than that, though. It goes from 34 to 1986. Why was that interval chosen?
Well, there were a couple of reasons that I wanted to go back before World War II and look at the kind of run up to the post-war era. One was that I thought it was important to point out that there was basically nothing built, certainly not in the Loop, between 1934 and the kind of late 1940s. And some of that was economics. The Depression and then World War II meant that there was, you know, nothing in the way of business development going on in the Loop's real estate. But it also reflected the way that the city's politics worked. I wanted to show that, you know, the city council actually passed zoning laws in the early 40s that outlawed skyscrapers entirely, not just downtown, but throughout the city. And that was a you know, a not surprising thing when you think about the lack of market, but also the fact that there are many, many, many more landowners outside the Loop who wanted the kind of value of that land to get spread out versus those that were actually in the Loop. The other reason was that a lot of the technology that went into these post-war buildings had been developed in the 20s and 30s and was sort of sitting there idle while very few skyscrapers were being built. And I thought it was important to go back to the field building and to show that in 1934, that was a state-of-the-art building, you know, first new construction in Chicago to have air conditioning. You know, it used aluminum, it used high-speed elevators, and the technologies that were circulating at the time hadn't yet been applied. So insulated glazing, you know, welded steel, curtain walls, things like that were still out there, but they were still in the laboratory, essentially. And to go back to that point and to say, well, here's what the city's building stock was, but also here's where the state of the art was, that to me, I think, lets you tell a fuller picture about what happens when the zoning code changes, but also when the market picks back up and there are all these technologies sort of, spinning their wheels ready to go. And so, one of the first tall buildings you see is 860-880 Lakeshore Drive, which we think of as, the prototypical modern skyscraper. And it's using technologies that have been sitting there for a generation. And that's, that's the first building where not only the zoning code, but also the building code has changed. And so, to my mind, it's like the wheels are spinning, they're kind of burning rubber, but they're not going anywhere. And then all of a sudden, when the economy picks up, architects and builders can take advantage of this kind of new palette of tools that they have.
Yeah, and I should mention, I mean, there's something in this book for everyone. There's definitely the people who want to just look at this in the terms of the intersection of politics and the sort of big urban scale planning decisions that were made. But also, if you're interested in looking at muntins and mullions, there's also a lot of about muntins and mullions and aluminum and rubber gaskets and just the minute details that go into, creating facades and this type of thing. So it's really, quite magisterial in terms of its scope. Did you bring it to a conclusion in 1986, because of the construction of the Thompson Center, or for some other reason?
Yeah, the Thompson Center to me really closed the book in a way. It finished the arc in a lot of ways. For one thing, it's kind of the anti-skyscraper, right? It's turned inside out. It takes up a whole block, but it's only 14 stories. All these things that kind of reversed a lot of the logic that the book started out with. It also was the last piece of the Central Area Plan to get put into place. The original plan in 1957 contemplated a city government center, a federal government center, and a state government center. And so state of Illinois was the last piece. And it was the only piece built along with the transportation center north of it in Arthur Rubloff's North Loop plan, which to me was a good sort of closing piece because it suggested such a radical rethinking of most of the loop, turning 10 or 12 blocks into what would have been a giant shopping mall. So to me, I felt like you had to close those stories out. The thing that I found out as I was researching it is that C.F. Murphy, who is this Zelig figure who starts his career as a secretary for Daniel Burnham, ends up leading probably the most prolific architecture firm in the city in the 60s and 70s, hiring a young draftsman from Germany named Helmut Jahn, seeing the firm become Murphy Jahn. Well, C.F. Murphy died 2 weeks after State of Illinois opened. And to me, that you wouldn't believe that in a film script, right? It's just too perfect. So there were a lot of kind of arcs that felt like they finished with State of Illinois and therefore in 1986. It's also true that there was an awful lot of very interesting building that happened in the late 80s, early 90s, and at some point, you got to slice it somewhere, and leave room for a third volume.
And I assume that is forthcoming.
Well, if you do the math, when the first book came out and what it covered, the second book, what it covered, I figure sometime in the 2040s would be a good time to put the third volume out. I think you have to give these things a little time, and be able to look back on them. So no immediate plans, but that's the natural question to ask is what do you cover next, and what are the forces that go into the third or fourth generation of Chicago high rises?
Yeah, and I, now that you mentioned two, critical buildings that are, the sort of the pinpoints of your analysis here, have recently come back into the news, right? because the State of Illinois building is no longer the State of Illinois building. It was sold in a very complex property deal to the Prime Group, and then leased, long-term leased, I guess, to Google, mm-hmm. when we don't know exactly what they're going to do with it.
Yeah.
And then the Field building is also was also re-involved in a transaction recently, which is a little more run-of-the-mill. But what do you think it means that these two, you know, nodes of your analysis are now, you know, in the news again?
Well, it's one of the big questions right now. You know, what do you do with buildings that are 40 years old in the case of the State of Illinois Center, or, you know, getting up to 90 or 100 years old? You know, one thing that I think that if and when there is ever a third book, one of the big stories is going to be reusing, recycling, reoccupying buildings after things have changed quite a bit. Those buildings of the 1920s have made for great conversions into things like hotels and apartments because they have a such a narrow core to skin dimension. And so, you know, the analogy is that, well, in the 20s, offices needed to be near windows for, you know, ventilation and for light. And now, you know, residential occupancies need adjacency to windows for the same things. So there's a kind of nice one-to-one there. I think the question about what you do with State of Illinois or the lower floors of Sears, where you have these gigantic core to skin distances, is a very, very different question. And, you know, it takes a company like Google that has a need just for massive amounts of worker space and floor space and isn't necessarily worried about whether that space is attractive to potential tenants or not. You know, it takes a company like that to occupy some of these later post-war buildings. And I think that story is yet to be written. There is a lot of very, very deep office floor space in the Loop that we're not quite sure what to do with now as the market is sort of softened with work from home and all that. You know, how you recycle buildings like that, I think, is a legitimate question.
I think it's going to come up over and over again. And, you know, the city has attempted to address that a little bit with the LaSalle Street redevelopment plan, which calls for some affordable housing to be brought in into these, you know, sort of underused 1920s buildings. But I guess a question would be, do you foresee large corporations coming back down to the Loop and building icons for themselves in the way that Sears did? I mean, there's an implication with somebody like Google coming in and taking over the entire building that's going to start a new trend. But even as we've seen with things like the newly constructed Salesforce Tower, Salesforce is got their name on it, but they're like barely in there and they're having all kinds of, you know, problems related to the broader economy. So, I mean, this is more of an economic than an architectural history question, I guess, which probably takes us both out of our depth, but since it's part of the analysis, I thought I'd ask.
Yeah. And I think that if you can draw any lessons from the kind of past generations, it's that the skyscraper always comes back, right? Whenever anyone says, oh, the skyscraper is a, you know, dead letter, they always come back, but they always come back in ways that no one's predicted. And so my guess is that, yes, we will continue to occupy and to build tall buildings in central business districts. We've already seen a shift away from kind of commercial construction to more mixed use or more residential. And I think that's one kind of surprise that, you know, 20 years ago, you would not have thought of building super tall apartment buildings in the middle of a business district. But I think that the kind of iconic corporate, you know, name on the top of it, tower, is probably something of the past. You know, like you said, Salesforce gets its name on the tower for what, by historic standards, is a relatively small lease. Still, you know, one of the largest in the building, but only for a handful of floors. And I think that, you know, the kind of iconic like Prudential building or Sears Tower, is almost certainly a thing of the past with so much work from home and so much kind of distributed workforce. People always want to be in proximity to one another, though, and people like to live near where they work. And that, I think, argues for certainly density, if not height. And density, in turn, argues for a continued market to build high, if not necessarily tall.
We have to talk about the John Hancock Center.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, and because the story of that is just, it's so dramatic from so many angles. You know, the structure is revolutionary. The kind of wranglings that had to happen in order to negotiate the site and get around someone who didn't want to sell, and the fact that they basically did what we're now seeing a lot of, but without the name transfer of handing the keys back to the financing company and saying, like, this building is yours now, finish it. That's quite a story. So how did you approach the scholarship on the John Hancock Center, now known as blandly 875 North Michigan?
Yeah, it's a much, much less evocative building title now. Well, so the Hancock to me was always the kind of, you know, this was the car chase scene in the book, right? This was what everything leads up to. This is a building that, you know, when I saw it for the first time at age 12, this is the building that made me want to be an architect, right? So I felt like I had to come into it and try to just be as sort of, you know, sober-minded as I could, right? Let's look at just the facts. But, you know, I think anyone reading the book will understand that I love that building dearly. The great thing about it to me is that, yes, you can look at it again as a kind of object, right? It's a really clever solution to a handful of programmatic and structural problems. Apartments, again, want a narrower core-to-skin depth. Offices want a bigger one. Parking garages want a bigger one. Department stores want an even bigger one. So when you stack all of those programs on top of one another, you know, initially they had thought about building two separate buildings, an office building with one depth and an apartment building with another. There's this story, possibly even true, about Bruce Graham getting frustrated and taking the model of one and putting it on top of the model of the other. And then Bruce Graham and Fosler Kahn, the engineer, realizing that if you struck a kind of tapered shape, you could solve all of those problems at once, while at the same time getting a structural form that had some natural stability to it. And when you marry that tapered shape to the ideas that Fosler Kahn had about tube structures, right, the benefits of sort of putting all of the structure on the perimeter of the building where it can most efficiently resist wind. And when you add to that the benefits of what Kahn called a truss tube, the cross bracing that runs up the side of it, you get a building that is functionally just incredibly efficient, structurally that uses less steel per square foot of leased area than any skyscraper of the era, any tall building like ever built. And you also get what I had never quite realized was an incredibly difficult design proposition, because every single floor now has different dimensions. It has one slope east-west. It has a different slope north-south. So every floor has to get recalculated, and all of that cross bracing has to intersect exactly the center line of the floors and columns that it connects to. And the apartment floors have a different floor-to-floor height than the office floors. So this is one of the reasons why this didn't get tried very much afterwards, right? It was an expensive thing to do from a kind of design labor point of view. But then, as you say, the financing story is absolutely amazing. The initial developer was the owner of the Philadelphia Eagles, who gets this giant insurance company as a main tenant, and literally and helps with the financing, and you know, it is literally a one person development project to begin with. And unfortunately, a construction problem that cropped up in the foundations, which is its own like great rabbit hole, but has to do with how you pour caissons and how, once they're poured, there's only so much you can know about what's going on down there. Well, one of the caissons failed as the steelwork was going up, and the months and months that it took to figure out what had happened, to go in and investigate all the caissons, to repair some of them, bankrupted Jerry Wolman, the original developer, who, as you said, basically had to hand the project to the John Hancock Insurance Company, who at that point had no option but to complete the project, right, no matter how much it was going to cost. All of these things, come together in a way that creates, to me, almost a like cinematic story. Just an incredible confluence of finance, of technology, of, everything that can go wrong on a construction site. And I think there's also like you can go forward then, and there's another story about, as you say, the Hancock pioneered mixed use, right? One of the first buildings, really tall buildings, where you can live above your office. And it also, irrevocably changed that part of the city, right? It had its own kind of economic gravity that attracted all sorts of other mega projects to what had been a pretty sleepy, North Michigan Avenue, changed irrevocably because, this giant investment there. So to me, the Hancock just encapsulates so much about what was going on in the city, what was going on in high-rise design, and also really kind of set the course for a decade or so of these kind of mega projects, both on the Magnificent Mile, but also elsewhere in Chicago, elsewhere in the world, right? It was a model for all sorts of mixed-use development, and a building that, along with Sears, like those two get their own chapter, right? Because they were so important in the way that Chicago skyscrapers developed.
There's a movie out about shorting GameStop, and you have Ken Griffin being played by Nick Offerman. How could this not be a more interesting story? We have to cast this movie. I mean,
I am right there with you. I think it would be amazing. I think there are all kinds of all kinds of plot twists in the Hancock getting built that would make for a great film. We could see if Offerman's still available.
yeah, right, exactly. I mean, he could be the developer. I mean, he could,
Sure.
he's great.
Yeah.
Well, I sometimes like to do this where I just sort of try to cast the movie live, but it always ends up falling apart after the first two or three names.
Sure.
Realizing that the depth of my cinematic knowledge is not as great as architecture, I suppose. So yeah, I think that you've really told a Chicago story, an American story here, that is extends beyond just architecture or construction, and it manages to synthesize all these things. What were your models in putting this together in terms of, did you look at other work of other historians? Did you look at work of other architectural or political historians?
Well, Carl Condit, of course, has always been an author that I've looked to, both in terms of the subject matter, obviously, right? He wrote the initial books on Chicago high rises, and I've always felt that a lot of what I've done has been either kind of filling in the blanks or a sort of very gentle, very friendly corrective to some of what he wrote. But I think too that Condit was always able to, in a way that I think is very familiar to Chicago, like bridge the kind of social aspects of building with the technical and the aesthetic ones. He understood that these buildings are not just gadgets, but they have kind of social dimensions and political dimensions and also, aesthetic dimensions. And even though the Chicago myth is that, oh yeah, no, we don't care about aesthetics. We're all about like expressing the technology. That's not really true, right? There's all kinds of fine level work that goes into, making the technology tell the story that you want. I think too that, I've always been interested in getting beyond kind of strict chronological structures, and one of the books that's always influenced me is Ken Frampton's Modern Architecture, A Critical History. And I was lucky to study under Frampton in grad school. And I've always appreciated that approach of, you know, instead of each chapter being like 1910 to 1920, it's thinking about, you know, what themes can you pull out that make their own kind of, you know, logical pieces or logical chapters. And so in any of these projects, like instead of just kind of laying out the rough chronology, which, I mean, of course I do, I think every historian probably starts with a spreadsheet of some sort. You know, I try to look for patterns that make kind of good stories on their own. And to me, the test is whether you can come to one chapter just completely cold and read it and have it kind of stand on its own. So Frampton, I think, has always been a model for me in terms of thinking about how to structure a book project. And Condit, you know, for the subject matter, that's always the first place I've gone when thinking about something in Chicago, just to see what he did, what he thought, and where I either disagree with it or where, you know, I think there's kind of further space to dig. Two probably pretty obvious examples, I guess.
Sure, and I was going to ask about, you know, Robert Caro or somebody like that, because of the, you know, the kind of the looking at the epic arc of personalities and cities and how much power individuals can wield if they architect it to use it as a verb, the architect the situation to their advantage.
Yeah, I mean, Caro, obviously, also like a huge hero for me. I don't have the, my editors would not let me get away with a 2000 page book. But that kind of depth, but also, like, as you say, understanding the connection between the kind of personal and the personal ambition and the effects that has on a larger city. You know, the Power Broker, his biography of Robert Moses is something that I, you know, plowed through in graduate school and still go back to. And interestingly, so there was a great, he wrote this book basically about his process. And I've found that the way he described his process, you know, very, very painstaking, you know, working with like individual note cards and things. And I do that too. I do it, you know, on a computer, not by hand. But I found it interesting that, you know, the process that I use kind of paralleled what Caro used. In other words, sort of going out and just getting thousands and thousands of facts, but then trying to find, or hundreds and hundreds in my case, maybe not thousands and thousands, and then trying to stitch them together in a way that tells a coherent story. That certainly felt familiar to me. So yeah, Caro is a great one, of course.
So yes, this is really quite a narrative, and much more than a, you know, dry recitation of, you know, construction facts. So I would recommend that anyone who's interested really in urban history, check out Chicago Skyscrapers 1934 to 1986. My guest today has been Tom Leslie. He's a professor at the University of Illinois and a researcher of skyscraper history. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you. Good to be here.